"You've already give it to me," said Mac, and he felt like a fool the moment he'd said it. "I need better equipment," said Doc. "God damn it, I can't see without better equipment." "Doc, how about you and me stepping over and getting a half pint of old tennis shoes?"
"Fine," said Doc.
"I'll buy," said Mac. "I've got a couple of loose bucks." Doc said sharply, "I'll have to get some money. Where can I get some money, Mac?"
"I told you, I'll buy, Doc."
"I'll need a wide-angle binocular scope and light. I'll have to find out about light. Maybe a pinpoint spot from across the room." No, they'd move out of that. "Maybe there are new kinds of lights. I'll have to look into it." "Come on, Doc." Doc bought a pint of old tennis shoes and later sent Mac out with money to buy another pint. The two of them sat in the laboratory side by side, staring into the aquarium, resting their elbows on the shelf, and they got to the point where they were mixing a little water with the whiskey. "I got an uncle with an eye like them," said Mac. "Rich old bastard, too. I wonder why, when you get rich, you get a cold eye."
"Self-protection," said Doc solemnly. "Conditioned by relatives, I guess."
"Like I was saying, Doc, everybody in the row is worried about you. You don't have no fun. You wander around like you was lost."
"I guess it's reorientation," said Doc.
"Well, some people think you need a dame to kind of nudge you out of it. I know a guy that every time he gets feeling low, he goes back to his wife. Makes him appreciate what he had. He goes away again and feels just fine."
"Shock therapy," said Doc.
"I'm all right, Mac. Don't let anybody give me a wife, though. Don't let them give me a wife. I guess a man needs a direction. That's what I've been needing. You can only go in circles so long."
"I kind of like it that way," said Mac.
"I'm going to call my paper Symptoms in Some Cephalopods Approximating Apoplexy."
"Great God Almighty," said Mac.
Chapter 4. There Would Be No Game. As he got to know him, Joseph and Mary regarded Doc with something akin to love, for love feeds on the unknown and unknowable. Doc's honesty was exotic to Joseph and Mary. He found it strange. It attracted him in spite of the fact that he could not understand it. He felt that there was something he had missed, though he could not figure what it was. One day, sitting in Western Biological, Joseph and Mary saw a chessboard and, finding that it was a game and being good at games, he asked Doc to teach him. J&M easily absorbed the characters and qualities of castles and bishops and knights and royalty and pawns. During the first game, Doc was called to the telephone, and when he returned, he said, "You've moved a pawn of mine, and your queen and knight."
"How'd you know?" the patron asked.
"I know the game," said Doc. "Look, Joseph and Mary, chess is possibly the only game in the world in which it is impossible to cheat."
Joseph and Mary inspected this statement with amazement.
"Why not?" he demanded. "If it were possible to cheat, there would be no game," said Doc.
J&M carried this away with him. It bothered him at night. He looked at it from all angles, and he went back to ask more about it. He was charmed with the idea, but he couldn't understand it. Doc explained patiently, "Both players know exactly the same things. The game is played in the mind."
"I don't get it."
"Well, look. You can't cheat in mathematics or poetry or music because they're based on truth. Untruth or cheating is just foreign. It has no place. You can't cheat in arithmetic."
J
Joseph and Mary shook his head. "I don't get it," he said. It was a shocking conception, and he was drawn to it because, in a way, its outrageousness seemed to him like a new, strange way of cheating. In the back of his mind, an idea stirred. Suppose you took honesty and made a racket of it. It might be the toughest of all to break. It was so new to him that his mind recoiled from it, but still it wouldn't let him alone. His eyes narrowed. "Maybe he's worked out a system," he said to himself. Chapter 5. Enter Susie. It is popular to picture a small-town constable as dumb and clumsy. In the books, he plays the stock bumpkin part, and people retain this attitude even when they know it's not true. We have so many beliefs we know are not true. A constable, if he has served for a few years, knows more about his town than anyone else, and on all levels. He is aware of the delicate political balance between the mayor and the councilman, fire department, and insurance companies. He knows why Mrs. Geltham is giving a big party and who is likely to be there. Usually he knows, when Mabel Andrews reports a burglar, whether it is a rat in the dining room, a burglar, or just wishful thinking. A constable knows that Mr. Gotham is sleeping with the schoolteacher, and how often. He knows when high school boys have switched from gin to marijuana. He's aware of every ripple on the town's surface. If there's a crime, the constable usually knows who didn't do it, and often who did. With a good constable on duty, 100 things don't happen that might. Sometimes there's a short discussion in an alley, sometimes a telephone call, sometimes only his shadow under a streetlight. When he gets a cat down out of a tree, he knows all about the owner of the cat. And many weeping, parent-prodded little boys and girls put small things stolen from the five and dime in the constable's hands, and he, if he is a good constable, gives them a sense of mercy and justice without injuring the dignity of the law. A stranger getting off the Del Monte Express in Monterey wouldn't be aware that his arrival was noted, but if something happened that night, he would know it all right. Monterey's Joe Blakey was a good constable. He wouldn't ever be chief, didn't much want to be. Everybody in town liked Joe and trusted him. He was the only man in town who could stop a husband and wife fight. He came by his techniques in both social life and in violence from being the youngest of 15 nice but violent children. Just getting along at home had been his teacher. Joe knew everyone in Monterey, and he could size up a stranger almost instantly. When a girl named Susie got off the Greyhound bus, she looked up and down the street, fixed her lipstick, then lifted her beat-up suitcase and headed for the Golden Poppy restaurant. Susie was a pretty girl, with a flat nose and a wide mouth. She had a good figure, was 21, 5'5", hair probably brown, dyed blonde, brown cloth coat, rabbit skin collar, cotton print dress, brown calf shoes, heel taps a little run over, scuff on the right toe. She limped slightly on her right foot. Before she picked up her suitcase, she opened her brown purse of simulated leather. In it were mirror, comb with two teeth missing, lucky strikes, matchbook that said Hotel Rosaline, San Francisco, half pack of peppermint lifesavers, 85 cents in silver, no folding money, lipstick but no powder, tin box of aspirin, no keys. If there had been a murder that night, Joe Blakey could have written all that down, but now he wasn't even aware that he knew it. Joe acted pretty much by instinct. He got into the Golden Poppy just as the waitress was putting a cup of coffee on the counter in front of Susie. Joe slipped onto the stool next to her. "Hi, Ella," he said to the waitress. Cup of coffee.
Coming up, said Ella. How's your wife, Joe?
Oh, pretty good. Wish she'd get her strength back, though.
Takes it out of you, said Ella. Man can't understand that. Give her a tonic and let her rest. I'll have fresh coffee in a minute if you want to wait.
Yeah, said Joe.
Ella went to the head of the counter, put coffee in the Silex, and filled the bowl. Joe said quietly to Susie,
What's on your mind, sister?
Not a thing, said Susie.
She didn't look at him, but she could see him in the shine of a malted machine behind the counter.
Vacation?
Sure.
How long?
Don't know.
Looking for a job?
Maybe.
Ella started toward them, saw what was happening, and got busy at the other end of the counter. Joe asked, Know anybody here?
I got an aunt here.
What's her name?
That your business?
Yep.
All right, I got no aunt.
Joe smiled at her, and Susie felt better. She liked a guy who was worried about his wife. He said to her, On the bum?
Not yet, said Susie. You gonna give me trouble, mister?
Not if I can help it, said Joe. You got a Social Security card?
Lost it, said Susie.
Joe said, It's a tough town. All organized. Don't work the street. The authorities won't have it. If you need a buck to blow town, come to me. My name's Joe Blakey.
Thanks, Joe. But I ain't hustling. Honest.
Not yet you ain't, said Joe.
It's a hell of a town to get a job in since the cannery's closed. Take it easy.
He stood up and stretched.
I'll get the coffee later, Ella, he said, and went out.
Ella's work seemed to be all done. She mopped the counter with a damp cloth.
Swell fella, she said. More coffee? Fresh is ready.
Seemed like, said Susie.
Yeah.
Ella brought a fresh cup.
Where are you staying?
Don't know yet.
My sister rents rooms. Pretty nice. $4 a week. I can give her a ring, see if she's got one vacant.
I think I'll look around town a while, said Susie. Say, mind if I leave my suitcase here? It's kind of heavy.
Sure. I'll put it back at the counter here.
Well, suppose you're off shift when I come back.
Ella looked levelly at Susie.
Sister, she said, I ain't never off shift.
Susie looked in the store windows on Alvarado Street, and then she went to the wharf and watched the fishing boats at their moorings. A school of tiny fish always lay in the shade of the pier, and two little boys fished with hand lines and never caught anything. About 4 o'clock, she strolled along deserted Cannery Row, bought a package of Lucky Strikes at the grocery, glanced casually at Western Biological, and knocked on the door of the Bear Flag. Fauna received her in the combination bedroom and office.
"I'll tell you the truth," said Fauna. "Business ain't been good. It may pick up some in June. I wish I could put you on. Ain't you got a hard luck story that would kind of sway me?"
"Nope," said Susie.
"You broke?"
"Yep."
"But you don't make nothing of it."
Fauna leaned back in her swivel chair and squinted her eyes.
"I used to work a mission," she said. "I know hard luck stories from both ends. I guess if you laid all the hard luck I've heard end to end, why, the Bible would look short. But some of them stories was true. Now, I could make a guess about you."
Susie sat silent. Posture, hands, face, noncommittal.
"Lousy home," said Fauna. "Fighting all the time. Probably you wasn't more than 15 or 16 when you married the guy, or maybe he wouldn't. Done it just to get away from the fighting. Susie made no reply. Fauna looked away so that she wouldn't see the hands slowly grip each other. Got in a family way right off, said Fauna. That made the guy restless, and he powdered. What did you say?
I didn't say nothing, said Susie.
Where's the baby?
I lost it.
Do you hate the guy?
I got nothing to say, said Susie.
Okay with me. I ain't really very interested. There's some dames born for this business. Some are too lazy to work, and some hate men. Don't hardly none of them enjoy what they're doing. That would be like a bartender that loves to drink. You don't look like a natural-born hustler to me. You ain't lazy. Why don't you get a job?
I worked waitress, and I worked five and dime.
Only difference is, you get took to a movie instead of $3, said Susie.
You trying to make a steak?
Maybe.
Got a boy?
Nope.
Hate boys?
Nope. Fauna sighed. You got me, sister. I can feel myself being got. You're a tough kid. Doing your own time like an old con. I like that. It works better with me than a hard luck story.
Tell me, you hot?
Huh?
Under wraps, I mean. Anybody got anything on you?
Nope.
Ever done time?
Once. 30 days. Vagrancy.
Nothing else on the blotter?
Nope.
Can you give off a smile? You'd freeze the customers.
Susie grinned at Fauna.
Good God Almighty, said Fauna. You look like somebody's sister. I'm afraid you'll cost me. Why do I have to be a pushover? Ever worked a house?
Nope.
Well, it ain't as bad as the street. Doc Wilkins will be in tomorrow.
Susie asked, can I get my suitcase?
I guess so.
Fauna opened a wallet on her desk.
J.C. Penney's is open till 6. Get yourself a dress. Fancy but cheap. Get a new toothbrush. And when you come back, for God's sake, go to work on your hair. You could be a good-looking kid if you worked it up.
I've been riding a bus, said Susie.
That'll do it, said Fauna. We eat at 6:30. How long since you ate?
Yesterday.
Beef stew tonight, cream carrots, cherry jello for dessert.
On her way to the door, Susie paused and her hand patted the door frame.
Cop worked me over today, she said. Name's Joe Blakey.
He's a nice fella.
Why, he'd lend you dough, said Fauna.
That's what he said, Susie replied. I love beef stew.
At the Golden Poppy, Ella handed the suitcase over the counter.
You look like a kid with a job, said Ella.
Looks like. Say, where's J.C. Penney?
Turn right and go a block and a half. Yellow front.
Be seeing you.
Sure, said Susie.
On the sidewalk, Joe Blakey fell into step beside her and took her suitcase from her hand.
That's a good woman, he said. You just keep your nose clean and you'll be all right.
How'd you know? Susie asked.
She called me, said Joe. See you around.
Okay, said Susie.
She took her suitcase from him and turned into J.C. Penney's.
Can I help you?
Dress, not too dear.
Over here. I like that tomato we won. That's a new shade. Love apples.
Tomato color.
It's rayon. It'll give you good service.
It better. Size 12.
Shoes to match?
Susie took a very deep breath.
Yes, by God, she said.
Chapter 6. The Creative Cross. For days,
The flame burned in Doc, his phoenix thought. True, he didn't have a proper microscope, but he had eyes, and he had, thank God, an analytic mind that could slough off sensations, emotions, pains. As he stared at the octopi, his thesis took form. With a glass needle, he stimulated one to fear and rage until it attacked and killed its brother. He removed one passive octopus to a separate jar, where he subjected it to mild solutions of menthol, of Epsom salts, sickening it a little, and then bringing it back to health again. Then he aroused rage, and when the body colors pulsed and changed, he introduced a small amount of cocaine sulfate and saw the emotion disappear into sleep, if you can say an octopus sleeps. Then he aroused it with saline and touched it here and there with the frustrating needle, noted the flush, the growing intensity of color, the uncertain whipping and groping of the arms, until suddenly it collapsed and died. Doc removed the body and dissected the tissue, trying to find burst vesicles. "It works," he said aloud. "I haven't proper equipment to see how it happens, but this animal dies with the appearance of apoplexy. There must be a leakage even if I can't see it. I can start my paper with observation." Doc bought a package of yellow pads and 2 dozen pencils. He laid them out on his desk, the pencils sharpened to needle points, and lined up like yellow soldiers. At the top of a page he printed, "Observations and Speculations." His pencil point broke. He took up another and drew lace around the O and the B, made a block letter of the S, and put fish hooks on either end. His ankle itched. He rolled down his sock and scratched, and that made his ear itch. "Someone's talking about me," he said, and looked at the yellow pad. He wondered whether he had fed the cotton rats. It's easy to forget when you're thinking. Watching the rats scrabble for the food he gave them, Doc remembered that he had not eaten. When he finished a page or two, he would fry some eggs. But wouldn't it be better to eat first so that his flow of thought would not be interrupted later? For some days he had looked forward to this time of peace, of unbroken thought. These were the answer to his restlessness, peace and the life of the mind. It would be better to eat first. He fried 2 eggs and ate them, staring at the yellow pad under the hanging light. The light was too bright. It reflected painfully on the paper. Doc finished his eggs, got out a sheet of tracing paper, and taped it to the bottom of the shade below the globe. It took time to make it neat. He sat in front of the yellow pad again and drew lace around all the letters of the title, tore off the page, and threw it away. 5 pencil points were broken now. He sharpened them and lined them up with their brothers. A car drove up in front of the bear flag. Doc went to the window and looked out. No one he knew, but he saw Mac go into the grocery. He remembered he wanted to ask Mac something. It's always hard to start to concentrate. The mind darts like a chicken, trying to escape thinking, even though thinking is the most rewarding function of man. Doc could take care of this. When you know what you're doing, you can handle it. He set his jaw and was starting to turn back to his desk when he saw out of the corners of his eyes the flash of a skirt. He looked out the window again. A girl had come out of the bear flag and was walking along Cannery Row toward Monterey. Doc couldn't see her face, but she had a fine walk, thigh and knee and ankle swinging free and proud. No jerk and totter the way so many women walked as they fell from step to step. No, this girl walked with her shoulders back and her chin up and her arms swinging in rhythm. It's a gay walk, Doc thought. You can tell so much by a walk, discouragement or sickness,
determination. There are squinched-up, mean walks and blustering walks, shy, creeping walks. But this was a gay walk, as though the walker were going happily to a meeting with someone she loved. There was pride in the walk, too, but not vanity. Doc hoped she would not turn the corner, but she did. There was a flick of skirt, and she was gone. But Doc could see in his mind her swinging limbs, the melody of her swift movement. Probably ugly as a mud fence, he thought, and then he laughed at himself. "That's full circle," he said. "Mind, I congratulate you. You jumped me to sex, translated it to aesthetics, and ended with sour grapes. How dishonest can I be? And all because I don't want to go to work. I'll work my head off to avoid work. Come, mind. This time, you don't get away with it. Back to the desk." He picked up a pencil and wrote, "The observed specimens were 20 small octopi taken in the intertidal zone near the town of La Jolla. Specimens were placed in a large aquarium under conditions as nearly approximating their natural habitat as possible. Seawater was continuously filtered and replaced every 24 hours. Animals from a typical ecological community were introduced, together with sand, rock, and algae taken from the collecting point. Small crustaceans were supplied. In spite of precautions, 5 individuals died within 1 week. The remaining 15 seemed to become acclimatized and readily captured and consumed the small grapsoid crabs placed in the aquarium. The lights..." His pencil point broke. He took another, and it broke with a jerk, making a little tear in the paper. He read what he had written. "Dull, desiccated," he thought. "Why should I presume that an animal so far removed from the human..." Perhaps I'm fooling myself. The middle voice sang subtly, "Looking for yourself in the water? Searching, little man, among the hydroids for your soul? Looking for contentment in vanity? Are you better than Mac, that you should use the secret priestly words of science to cover the fact that you have nothing to say?" And the bottom voice mourned, "Lonesome, lonesome. Let me up into the light and warmth. Lonesome." Doc jumped up and went to the aquarium and stared into the lighted water. From under a rock, an octopus looked out and one of its arms flicked rhythmically as though it led an orchestra, and the beat was gay and free and fluid, like the swinging thigh and knee and ankle. Doc put his face in the palm of his hand and pressed blackness on his eyes until specks of green and red light swarmed on his vision. And then he got up and went across the street for beer. Chapter 7. Tinder Is As Tinder Does. Joseph and Mary Rivas liked Fauna, even admired her, but he did feel that it was a little indecent for a woman to own the Bear Flag, a paying institution with a steady income. Operate it, yes, but not own it. The proprieties told Joseph and Mary there should be a man in the background to drain off the profits. It was his observation that when women had access to money, they got nervous. To his mind, a healthy woman was a broke woman. A dame with money was a kind of a half-assed man. She stopped working at being a woman, and, as everybody knows, the finest thing about a woman is that she is a woman. Joseph and Mary had given some thought to relieving Fauna of the responsibility of the profits. If he owned the Bear Flag and Fauna ran it, there would be a natural and practical balance. Fauna had so far figured her way out from under his philanthropy, but Joseph and Mary did not give up. particularly when it was no trouble not to. A good stock manipulator reads the financial page and looks for the stock he has, but he also notices other quotations too, just in case. Joseph and Mary kept that kind of eye on the bear flag. He felt that someday Fauna might look away from the dealer for a moment. Now that his own affairs ran smoothly, he was able to cast a benevolently rapacious eye about him. He knew about Susie before she had even gotten her clothes washed, and he felt that Fauna was slipping. "You got a quail there," he told Fauna. "That's Mary trouble if I ever seen it."
"I guess so," said Fauna.
"Why'd you take her on?"
"I let myself make a mistake once in a while," said Fauna. "She ain't a good hustler, but when I get through with her, she might make somebody a damn fine wife."
"She's making a patsy of you," said the patron.
"People got to be a patsy now and then," said Fauna. "You never feel real good if you never been a sucker. Once I went missionary down in South America."
"Why?" asked the patron.
"Can't remember right off."
"What did you do?"
"Taught them to love one another."
"What did they do?"
"Taught me to shrink heads."
"Savages," said the patron.
"No, they wasn't. Them headhunters was pretty nice people. Honest, too. When they sell you a head, they give good value. But there's always a wise guy. Like this Athatulagulu, a natural-born head hustler. He'd worked out a way to push monkey heads. Gave them a close shave, didn't have to shrink them much. There's people will buy anything."
"I know," said the patron.
"Well, the bishop come through," said Fauna, "and he give me holy hell for buying up them monkey heads."
"You mean to say you bought them?" said the patron.
"Well, sure I bought them. I got a box of them in the woodshed. Everybody said I was a fool, but it paid off."
"How did it pay off?"
"Well, look," said Fauna. "My bunch was honest, and they shrunk honest heads. Suppose a shipment goes out, and this joker Athatulagulu slips in a couple of his monkey heads. Pretty soon, nobody don't trust nobody. Why, people would get to looking ass pants at a real nice head. I bought them up to keep them off the market. I had my reputation to think of."
"Yeah, but this joker," the patron began.
"I know what you're gonna say, and he done it, too. He had me. He charged me more for them monkey heads than I paid for the real article. He knew he had me."
"That's what I thought. Anybody would," said the patron.
"Oh, it all worked out," said Fauna. "If you ever buy a chungla head, you'll know you got the best."
"Yeah, but how about this joker?" said the patron.
Fauna opened up her desk drawer, took out a beautiful little item, black as polished ebony and no bigger than a lemon. "He made up real nice, didn't he?" said Fauna. The patron looked nervously away.
"I gotta get back," he said. "I left my nephew in the store."
"Don't he play trumpet?"
"Drives me crazy," said Joseph and Mary. "Got a new trumpet. Can't get away from it. Made him go practice down on the beach. Figured the waves and the sea lines would kind of drown him out. The other night, he gave a passing signal to a Navy tug, and they're still looking for what passed them. But last night was the worst. He was practicing down on the beach, and he aimed his damn trumpet into the sewer pipe. Got resonance, he said. I don't know if it's true, but I heard that every toilet in the whole neighborhood give off with stormy weather. Old Lady Somers was taking an enema. I don't believe what they said happened."
"I gotta get back. That kid can break glass with a high note." "Come over and visit again," said Fauna.
"You mind what I said about Susie?"
"I will," said Fauna. It's a funny thing, but you never like to trade at your own place. The store across the street has always got fresher cigarettes than you have.
The girls at the Bear Flag never got cigarettes from the slot machine at the Bear Flag. When they wanted Luckies or a 7-Up, they went to the Patrons. For that matter, nearly everyone in Cannery Row went nearly every place in Cannery Row nearly every day. Joseph and Mary had hardly got back to the grocery before Susie came in. You wouldn't recommend Joseph and Mary as a celebrator of God's loveliest creation, but if you wanted a quick assay on a babe, you couldn't ask for better than Joseph and Mary's. If he was not involved in an emotional way, he was good. Between the time Susie got change and the time she pushed the lucky strike button on his cigarette machine, each had gone over the other and registered the result. Susie's note? Greaseball. Smart and mean. Look out if he gives you something. A percentage boy. Smiles with his mouth. Eyes like a snake. May trip himself someday by being too smart. Patron's note? Lousy risk for a house. A character. Won't play the rules. Might reverse the field. Too friendly. If she likes a guy, she might toss in her roll. The patron would have kicked her out of the Bear Flag. He knew that the only person you can trust is an absolutely selfish person. He always runs true to form. You know everything he'll do. But you take somebody with an underlying kindness, and he might fool you. The only satisfactory sucker is the one who is entirely selfish. You never have any trouble with that kind. Fauna was laying herself wide open. Joseph and Mary tabulated Susie the way he might have bought a used car. Pretty good figure. Good ankles and legs. Too light in the butt and too heavy in the chest. That's a bad sign. A good hustler is flat-chested. Face kind of pretty if she felt like it. Face reflected how she felt. Good-looking if she felt good. A good hustler has a mask. Looks the same to everybody. Pretty, but you don't remember what she looked like the next morning. Susie, you wouldn't forget. A real bad risk. Susie liked people or she didn't like them. That in itself was bad. Cacahuete, the patron's nephew, was dusting shelves, and he flashed a gold smile at Susie. Susie lighted up. She didn't smile, she grinned. Her lips were full and mouth wide, and when she grinned, her eyes crinkled and something warm and scary came out of her. That's a bad risk. On top of this was toughness, but not dependable, dull toughness. Susie might take a poke at Jack Dempsey. She wasn't smart. All in all, Joseph and Mary would have dumped Susie in a minute. She'd be the kind of dumb dame who'd fall for some guy without finding out his bank balance. She was the kind, he thought, who'd give one guy a hell of a lot of trouble, but who'd be lousy playing the field. She had something of the same quality Doc had. The patron decided to warn Fauna again. This kid could be pure murder in a hook shop. Such was the patron's reasoned opinion, and the patron was a professional. If you'd take a doctor's advice about a disease, you'd surely take the patron's about a hustler. Both could be wrong, of course. The appraisals and judgments were almost instantaneous, so that by the time Susie had opened her cigarettes, put one in her mouth and lighted it, the judgment was complete. "How are you?" Joseph and Mary asked. "Okay," said Susie. "Fauna wants some yellow pads and a couple of pencils, soft pencils." The patron laid them out. "She does a lot of writing," he said. "She's used 6 pads in about a month."
"She's doing astrology."
"You believe that stuff?"
"No, but it don't do no harm."
"I knew a guy made a good living with it," said the patron.
"Oh, she don't charge nothing," said Susie.
"I know," said the patron. "I can't figure why not. Fauna ain't dumb."
"She sure ain't," said Susie.
Doc came in with 2 empty beer bottles. "Get a couple of cold ones back on the ice, will you?" he asked. Susie glanced at him, took him in and looked away. His beard shocked her a little. She didn't stare at him the way you don't stare at a cripple. The patron said, "Why don't you put in an icebox? Then you can take a case at a time." "It's easier to let you keep the ice," said Doc. "You know Susie here? She's new at the Bear Flag." "How do you do?" said Doc. "How do you do?" said Susie. She would have said hi to anyone else. When Doc had gone, the patron said, "That's a funny guy."
"It takes all kinds," said Susie.
"He knows stuff I ain't even heard of." The patron was defending Doc the way everyone did.
"Kind of hoity-toity?" asked Susie.
"Hell no! That's the way he always talks. He don't know no other way."
"Well, I guess it takes all kinds," said Susie.
"He gets bugs and stuff out of the ocean and sells them."
"Who to?"
"Why, there's people'll buy anything," said the patron.
"I guess so. Why don't other people do it?"
"Too much work, and you gotta know what to get."
"Say, why does he wear that beard? I used to know a wrestler wore one."
"I don't know why," said the patron. "Why'd the wrestler?"
"Thought it made him look tough."
"Well, maybe Doc the same, but no, he don't want to be tough." The patron went on. "In the army, they made a guy with a beard shave it off. Said a guy with a beard wanted to be different, and the best way to not get along in the barracks is to be different."
"Maybe that's it," said Susie. "I don't mind a different guy if he ain't too different."
"Dames can take it," said the patron. "They don't like it, but they can take it. What the hell am I doing all this talking for? I got work to do."
Susie asked, "You Mexican?"
"American. My old man was Mexican."
"Can you talk that spick talk?"
"Sure."
"Parlez-vous?"
"That ain't the same kind," said the patron.
"Be seeing you," said Susie,
and she went out and let the screen door slam.
"She ain't a bad kid," the patron thought, "but I'd sure kick her the hell out of the Bear Flag."
Doc looked out the window of Western Biological. He watched Susie walk past the vacant lot and up to the front porch of the Bear Flag. Just as she was about to climb the steps, she turned and looked around. She thought someone was looking at her. She didn't see Doc.
Chapter 8. The Great Roque War. Pacific Grove and Monterey sit side by side on a hill bordering the bay. The two towns touch shoulders, but they are not alike. Whereas Monterey was founded a long time ago by foreigners, Indians and Spaniards and such, and the town grew up higgledy-piggledy without plan or purpose, Pacific Grove sprang full-blown from the iron heart of a psycho-ideo-legal religion. It was formed as a retreat in the 1880s and came fully equipped with laws, ideals, and customs. On the town's statute books, a deed is void if liquor is ever brought on the property. As a result, the sale of iron and wine tonic is fantastic. Pacific Grove has a law that requires you to pull your shades down after sundown and forbids you to pull them down before. Scorching on bicycles is forbidden, as is sea bathing and boating on Sundays. There is one crime, which is not defined, but which is definitely against the law. Hijinks are or is forbidden. It must be admitted that most of these laws are not enforced to the hilt. The fence that once surrounded the Pacific Grove retreat is no longer in existence. Once, during its history, Pacific Grove was in trouble. Deep trouble. You see, when the town was founded, many old people moved to the retreat, people you'd think didn't have anything to retreat from.
These old people became grumpy after a while and got to interfering in everything and causing trouble until a philanthropist named Deems presented the town with two roque courts. Roque is a complicated kind of croquet with narrow wickets and short-handled mallets. You play off the sidelines, like billiards. Very complicated, it is. They say it develops character. In a local sport, there must be a competition and a prize. In Pacific Grove, a cup was given every year for the winning team on the roque courts. You wouldn't think a thing like that would work up much heat, particularly since most of the contestants were over 70, but it did. One of the teams was called the Blues, and the other the Greens. The old men wore little skull caps and striped blazers in their team colors. Well, it wasn't more than 2 years before all hell broke loose. The Blues would practice in the court right alongside the Greens, but wouldn't speak to them. And then it got into the families of the teams. You were a Blue family or a Green family. Finally, the feeling spread outside the family. You were a partisan of the Blues or a partisan of the Greens. It got so that the Greens tried to discourage intermarriage with the Blues and vice versa. Pretty soon it reached into politics so that a Green wouldn't think of voting for a Blue. It split the church right down the middle. The Blues and the Greens wouldn't sit on the same side. They made plans to build separate churches. Of course, everything got really hot at tournament time. Things were very touchy. Those old men brought a passion to the game you wouldn't believe. Why, two octogenarians would walk away into the woods and you'd find them locked in mortal combat. They even developed secret languages so that each wouldn't know what the other was talking about. Well, things got so hot and feeling ran so high that the county had to take notice of it. A Blue got his house burned down, and then a Green was found clubbed to death with a roque mallet in the woods. A roque mallet is short-handled and heavy, and can be a very deadly weapon. The old men got to carrying mallets tied to their wrists by thongs, like battle axes. They didn't go any place without them. There wasn't any crime each didn't charge the other with, including things they'd outgrown and couldn't have done if they'd wanted to. The Blues wouldn't trade in Green stores. The whole town was a mess. The original benefactor, Mr. Deems, was a nice old fella. He used to smoke a little opium when it was legal, and this kept him healthy and rested so that he didn't get high blood pressure or tuberculosis. He was a benevolent man, but he was also a philosopher. When he saw what he had created by giving the roque courts to the Pacific Grove retreat, he was saddened and later horrified. He said he knew how God felt. The tournament came July 30th. And feeling was so bad that people were carrying pistols. Blue kids and green kids had gang wars. Mr. Deems, after a period of years, finally figured that as long as he felt like God, he might as well act like God. There was too much violence in town. On the night of July 29th, Mr. Deems sent out a bulldozer. In the morning, where the roque courts had been, there was only a deep, ragged hole in the ground. If he'd had time, he would have continued God's solution. He'd have filled the hole with water. They ran Mr. Deems out of Pacific Grove. They would have tarred and feathered him if they could have caught him, but he was safe in Monterey, cooking his yen shi over a peanut oil lamp. Every July 30th, to this day, the whole town of Pacific Grove gets together and burns Mr. Deems in effigy. They make a celebration of it, dress up a life-size figure, and hang it from a pine tree. Later, they burn it. People march underneath with torches, and the poor, helpless figure of Mr. Deems goes up in smoke every year. There are people who will say that this whole account is a lie, but a thing isn't necessarily a lie, even if it didn't necessarily happen. Chapter 9. Whom the gods love, they drive nuts. To a casual observer, Cannery Row might have seemed a series of self-contained and selfish units, each functioning alone with no reference to the others. There was little visible connection between La Ida's, the Bear Flag, the grocery, still known as Lee Chong's Heavenly Flower Grocery, the Palace Flophouse, and Western Biological Laboratories. The fact is that each was bound by gossamer threads of steel to all the others. Hurt one, and you aroused vengeance in all. Let sadness come to one, and all wept. Doc was more than first citizen of Cannery Row. He was healer of the wounded soul and the cut finger. Strongly entrenched in legality though he was, he found himself constantly edged into infringements by the needs of his friends, and anyone could hustle him for a buck without half trying. When trouble came to Doc, it was everybody's trouble. What was Doc's trouble? Even he didn't know. He was deeply, grievingly unhappy. For hours on end, he sat at his desk with a yellow pad before him and his needle-sharp pencils lined up. Sometimes his wastebasket was full of crushed, scribbled pages, and at others, not even a doodle went down. Then he would move to the aquarium and stare into it, and his voices howled and cried and moaned. "Right," said his top voice, and "search," sang his middle voice, and his lowest voice sighed, "lonesome, lonesome." He did not go down without a struggle. He resurrected old love affairs. He swam deep in music. He read the sorrows of Werther, but the voices would not leave him. The beckoning yellow pages became his enemies. One by one, the octopi died in the aquarium. He had worn thin the excuse of his lack of a proper microscope. When the last octopus died, he leaped on this as his excuse. When his friends visited him, he would explain, "You see, I can't go on without specimens, and I can't get any more until the spring tides. As soon as I have specimens and a new microscope, I can whip the paper right off." His friends sensed his pain and caught it and carried it away with them. They knew the time was coming when they would have to do something. In the Palace Flophouse, a little meeting occurred. Occurred because no one called it, no one planned it, and yet everyone knew what it was about. Wide Ida brooded hugely. The Bear Flag was represented by Agnes, Mabel, and Becky. All the boys were accounted for. The meeting began casually and obliquely, as all meetings should. Hazel said, "Wide Ida throwed out a drunk last night and sprained her shoulder." "I ain't as young as I used to be," Wide Ida said gloomily. "The drunk dared her," said Hazel. "He didn't even touch the sidewalk going out. If there was an Olympic event for A and C, Wide Ida would win it easy." "Sprained my shoulder up," said Wide Ida. They kept skirting their problem. Mac said, "How's Fauna been?"
"Pretty good. She got problems," said Agnes. Becky was delicately picking off nail polish. "That Fauna," she said, "she's a wonder. She's given us table-setting lessons. I bet if they was 35 forks, she'd know what every one of them was for."
"Ain't they to eat with?"
Hazel asked.
"Jesus, what a ignorant," said Becky. "I bet you don't know a dessert fork from a hole in the ground."
Hazel said belligerently, "You know what a Jackson fork is for?"
"No, what?"
"Just leave it lay and see who's a ignorant," said Hazel. Wide Ida asked, "Any change with Doc?" No, said Mac. I went over to see him last night. I wish there was something we could do.
They fell to musing. If the times were hard on Doc, they were equally hard on his friends, who loved him. Once he had been infallible. There was nothing he could not do because there was nothing he wanted to do very much. And in spite of themselves, a little contempt for him was growing in his friends. A kind and loving contempt that might never have happened if he had not once been so great. People who had once spoken his name with awe now felt better than he because he was no better than they.
I ain't got no ideas how to proceed, said Mac. Hazel said, How's about if we ask Fauna to do his horoscope? She's doing me right now.
You ain't got no future, said Mac.
I have too, said Hazel. I bet Fauna could tell us what to do about Doc.
Mac looked interested.
It's better than nothing, he said.
Hoxunt, Eddie, you dig up one of them kegs you buried during the war. Hazel, you ask Fauna to come over for a drink. Tell her to bring her star stuff.
Maybe she's got me finished, said Hazel.
It was a matter of some sorrow to Fauna that she didn't entirely believe in astrology, but she had found that nearly everyone wants to believe that the stars take notice of us. Her science gave her a means for telling people what they ought to do, and Fauna had definite ideas about what everybody ought to do. In spite of her secret skepticism, every once in a while she turned up a reading that astonished her. Hazel's horoscope had her breathless and baffled. She seriously considered burning it and never telling him. Hazel led her to the palace flophouse, and Mac poured her a drink from the keg. She tossed it off, still deep in thought.
"You got my stars wrote down?"
Hazel demanded anxiously.
Fauna regarded him sorrowfully. I don't want to tell you, she said.
Why not? Is it bad?
Awful, said Fauna.
Come on, tell me. I can take it.
Fauna sighed. I've checked it over and over, she said.
You sure you give me your true birthday?
Sure.
Then I don't see how it can be wrong.
She turned wearily and faced the others.
The stars say Hazel's going to be president of the United States.
There was a shocked silence.
I don't believe it, said Mac.
I don't want to be president, Hazel said, and he didn't.
There's no choice, said Fauna. The stars have spoke. You will go to Washington.
I don't want to, Hazel cried. I don't know nobody there.
I wonder where we could all go, said Whitey number two. I seen some islands in the Pacific that was pretty nice, but hell, Hazel would have them too. The U.S. got a mandate.
I won't take it, said Hazel.
Max said, We could kill him.
His stars don't say it, Fauna said. He's going to live to 78 and die from a spoiled oyster.
I don't like oysters, said Hazel.
Maybe you'll learn in Washington.
Max said, Maybe you made a mistake.
That's what I hoped for, said Fauna. I went over and over it. No, sir. Hazel is going to be president.
Well, we've weathered some pretty bad ones, Eddie offered forlornly.
Ain't they no way I can tell them I won't do it? Hell, I'll hide out, said Hazel desperately.
Fauna shook her head dismally.
I'll check again, she said, but I don't think you got a prayer.
You got 9 toes, Hazel?
I don't know.
Well, count.
Hazel took off his shoes and moved.